I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Florida U.S. Senator Marco Rubio helped pass an immigration reform bill in the Senate, but his efforts may have alienated some conservatives. I'll talk to 90.7 political commentators Lou Fry and Dick Batchelor about how immigration reform could play into Senator Rubio's presidential aspirations. And we'll discuss gubernatorial politics in Florida and more. Also, the Center for Ocean Atmospheric Prediction Studies at Florida State University forecast an above-average hurricane season this year. I'll speak with Keith Koch, the warning coordinator at the Orange County Office of Emergency Management, about how the county prepares for a hurricane season. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio now by 90.7's political commentators Lou Fry and Dick Batchelor. Lou Fry, a former Republican congressman, he's the founder of the Lou Fry Institute for Politics and Government at the University of Central Florida. Lou, nice to see you.
Good to see you.
Dick Batchelor is a former Democratic State House representative, and he's the founder and president of the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Welcome, Dick.
It's great to be back.
Well, let's launch straight into it. I want to talk a little bit about Senator Marco Rubio, and of course, along with the Senate Gang of Eight, he's been credited with moving comprehensive immigration reform through the Senate, and now that's in the House of Representatives. Lou, I want to ask you, Marco Rubio has fallen behind Rand Paul, Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, and others in a recent primary poll by Public Policy Polling for the 2016 Republican primary. Still a long way off, I know, but do you think this is because of his stance on immigration?
Yeah, no question about it. He knowingly took that hit. He looked at the deal. He's got the health care issue, which is really good. The conservatives are very happy with that. He's got immigration. People looked at him to do something and try and move it. He did that. He tried to move it. There's still an outside chance that the House will pick out a couple things in the Senate bill and pass it. I don't think it's a permanent kind of one. And it also showed that he's got a lot of guts. He isn't afraid to take on something he believes in. But it also shows he is not stupid politically, Dick, because he took that hit and immediately shifted over to the health care issue, where everybody said, hurrah, he's a real conservative.
Yep. Keep in mind that Rubio won with the backing of the Tea Party, which I think had more strength then than it does now. And a lot of them are still upset with him, however many there are, still upset with him on the immigration issue. But he did join up with the Gang of Eight, half of them Democrats, half Republicans. They passed a bill in the Senate. The House is going to probably fail to act unless they just have remnants of it passed. So, but as Lou said, then he quickly zigzagged, and now he's out there. We need to kill Obamacare. We need to kill it now. It's the only chance to kill it. And by the way, I'm going to be the leader on the abortion issue. 20-week term, outlaw abortions, just like Texas and other states have done. He's leading the effort there. So he's very good about, you know, kind of deflecting on one issue going to another. But he's basically moved, still in the right column, if you might look at that, not in the left column, but in the right column on all those issues. So he's still holding his ground, I think.
Do you see the Tea Party having much kind of influence over what happens in the Republican primary in a couple years' time?
It's really practically a congressional district by congressional district look at. It's not an overall thing. I think they've lost some of their clout, but there are still some areas where if you're not a Tea Party nominee, you're not going to get it.
Well, let me just ask again, Lou, just back to the issue of immigration reform. Do you think the Senate and House will be able to agree on some form of reform?
No, I don't think they can. They can maybe take out some areas like the homeland security issue, so forth. I don't think they can move much past that.
Well, let's bring it back to Florida politics now. For a couple months, Florida Republicans have been running a media campaign against the likely but not yet announced gubernatorial candidate Charlie Crist. And the campaign called This Day in Christery reminds Democrats just how much the former governor liked to tout his conservatism and how much Democrats used to dislike that. Lou Fry, I want to ask you, does this show the Republicans are expecting a fight if and when Charlie Crist announces his candidacy?
Well, there was a congressman around here who used the same principle, search for the weakest candidate and beat and have him win the primary. To a certain extent, I think the Republicans are testing that particular ability or campaign strategy in that with Charlie. And I'm really interested to see what's going to happen in 30 days, because also you're required to file your report, what you made or what you've not made, what you raised, I should say. And this is, it's sort of like a poker game. Up till now, we've been playing poker and there's a lot of down cards, five card stud, one card down. Now you turn over your bottom cards and everybody can see what you really had. And if you haven't raised much money, like some of the people, especially in the Democratic Party, you're going to fall by the wayside. On the other hand, if you unexpectedly see somebody in the Democrat side who's done better than you thought, they're going to get a big bump out of it, Dick.
It might be fait accompli. The fact is, unfortunately, Senator Nan Rich, who I personally like a lot, but as Lou said, if she hasn't raised any money, you can't go back and redo Walker Lawton in 1970 when he walked across the state of Florida and became United States Senator. You can't do that anymore. You need several $1 million to get some just minimal name recognition. Alex Sink has said she's not out totally, but she's not in. And if you don't get in and raise some money, and then this Charlie Crist shows up, and he's the only person on the bench that you can call, the coach can call in. So we might end up with Charlie Crist because we don't have another candidate.
Mm-hmm. Do you think he is the weakest candidate, though?
Well, he can be weakened because he's taken a number of positions on a number of issues. You know, he's pirouetted a lot, not that this governor hasn't. But, you know, they're going to spend a lot of money, and if the governor's going to spend $100 million, if he can raise that money without putting his own money in, that's obviously makes him a formidable candidate. Even though the governor's still at 40% in the polls, which is a very bad place to be when you're then coming headed to a reelection. But if the problem with Charlie Crist is, I don't know how, and I'm just saying, I don't know how he raises his money. You can't go back to the deep pockets of the Republicans and the Republican interest groups that funded you when you were a Republican. And not all Democrats yet trust you. And what we've said before, you got to watch the big contributors, the Mitch Bergers, the Richard Schwanz, the Jim Pughes. If they're on the sidelines, it's a bad omen for Charlie Crist.
Let me ask you too, Lou Fry, the Democratic Party, to counterpoint the Stay in Christery campaign, the Democratic Party has begun their campaign against Rick Scott. They don't have a formidable challenger, as we've discussed, in the race yet. But do you think this is a bit premature for them to be taking shots at the governor at this stage?
Not if you've got the money to be able to do it, and you can wound him a little bit. It's he's out there. He is a target. He has his percentages are low. Yet on the other hand, he has turned it around. He's got a better staff. He's acting more like a governor than as a CEO, if you will. Mm-hmm. He's been more effective at it. I think he's silenced a lot of the critics. So yeah, if that horse is running and you can cripple that horse a little, so he jogs along, that'd be fine. What the Democrats are hoping is somebody. Maybe the agriculture commissioner, Adam Putnam, maybe somebody in the Republican side at a high level will jump into this race. I don't think that's going to happen.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7. I'm Matthew Petty. We're speaking to political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. You can join the conversation online on Facebook and Twitter. You can also email us at intersection@wmfe.org. Well, let's talk now about a little more about President Obama. He was in Jacksonville last week as part of his economic roadshow intended to call attention to the plight of the middle class. Dick Batchelor, what's the president hoping to accomplish with these kind of speeches?
We're trying to get people to refocus on the economy and tying it to several things. I think the economy is broad-based, number one. Debt ceiling coming up very, very soon. That's going to be the first battle. And it could be a very, very vicious battle. You know, are there going to be any kind of tax cuts? Even the president has said, you think our corporate taxes are too high? They're willing to do away with some exemptions, looking at that. But then you tie that into and the rate reduction, what do you do about Medicare? And you've got Republican leaders saying they want to take Medicare and means test it, number one, and number two, raise the age for qualification. So it all ties in. But the president is basically saying, you know, if you look at income in the top 1%, it's increased by about 30%. But the ability to earn wages in the middle class has declined, is not keeping up. So we need job creation. We need to stimulate the economy. So that's kind of his theme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the question is, okay, the debt ceiling's got to be raised. The Republicans got to hold their nose, let it be raised. On the other hand, if that's going to happen, what are they going to get for it?
Right.
And that's where the whole thing comes down to that one basic argument. What are the Republicans going to get for their part of it? And it's a long way to go. Both people are lightly stepping around, shutting the government down. We went through that drill once with Newt Gingrich.
Right.
Didn't work very well. I think the Republicans were burned pretty bad on it, so they don't want to have them be the ones who are shutting the government down. It's sort of a dance with a cobra or something. I don't know what it is, but it's a dance. Neither party is very happy with the other, but it's the only dance in town.
Mm-hmm. But keep in mind what you're hearing in the echo chamber, though. Obamacare, Obamacare, Obamacare. Rubio and others, you know, this is its last chance to get rid of Obamacare. It is all tied together, and that's the reason it's hard to tease it apart because you've got all these elements. You know, what drives one vote versus another vote? And they basically say, you know, we'll do something on debt reduction or raise the ceiling on
the
debt.
Yeah, it'll be raised.
But in exchange for that, we want Medicare increase. We want means test for Medicare, and we want to do away with some of the requirements and on the taxes and penalties on Obamacare. You put that in the mix, and then how do you tease that apart? So it's like Bismarck said, there are two things you should not watch being made. One is sausage and one is laws.
Yeah. Well, little time left to make either.
Absolutely.
Let me ask about Obamacare then. I mean, the Affordable Care Act, rather, is it in danger still at this stage? Is there a chance that it could be shot down this late in the game?
No. I mean, they're all prancing about the issue. The fact is the Congress has tried 38 times to rescind Obamacare. It's not going to be rescinded. 95% of it is, you know, statutory. The president has some latitude about it. That's why he's pushed it back for a whole year, which I think, you know, was smart for him to do, to say we're just not quite ready for prime time. We need to push it back, and it takes some pressure off during the midterm elections. And also they need to get the act together. It's a very complex thing. But the fact is Obamacare will be there with Rubio and others, but the fact is the House has failed 38 times to rescind it, so the Senate's not going to take any action.
Well, just finally, gentlemen, I want to talk a little bit about the county level. Orange County Mayor Teresa Jacobs finishing this campaign quarter, raising more than $250,000. And there have been others that have announced they're considering or they're going to run, but none that really can compete financially with Jacobs at this stage. Dick Batchelor, do you think there's a Democratic challenger that can take Jacobs on, and when do they need to make that announcement?
I think it's gotten very late in the game. Once you raise $250,000, that demonstrates that you can raise $1 million. And Teresa can do that. The other advantage that Teresa has is she's also been able to secure the endorsement from and money from major Democratic contributors. Even though it's a bipartisan race, she's a Republican. It's a nonpartisan race, I'm sorry to say. Let me correct myself. It is a nonpartisan race. But it's getting late for anybody to get in and challenge an incumbent. Unless the incumbent really has messed up, it's very hard to challenge an incumbent in a nonpartisan race.
Let me ask you, Lou Fry, I mean, your colleague here, Dick Batchelor, mentions the fact that she's attracting money from Democratic contributors. How much do you think the fact that she's been able to work with Buddy Dyer on some big projects has played into that sort of
big
image of her as a bipartisan?
Yeah, she's done a good job. She hasn't made any real mistakes, a tweak here and there. She hasn't really done it. She's done a very professional job. She's worked hard at it. And a lot of people think that she's earned a chance to continue. But there's nothing you can reach out and say, look at what she did. We've got to throw her out of office. And also having, as Dick said, that $250,000, it's not just the money that she has. It'd be nice to have it, but she has really got a cross-section of people and leaders in different fields right sitting there, and you can look at it and you say, boy, she needs some more money. She can go back to these people, and if
Absolutely.
They're willing to put it in this early, they're more than willing to put it in because she looks like a winner.
Well, let me just finally ask you, I mean, if you mentioned the likes of a candidate who could be a solid candidate, Val Demings, would it be wise for her to get into a race against somebody who looks so established in the role as Mayor Jacobs, or should they keep their powder dry?
Politics of this pretty much is, she lost once, a tough race. Odds are against her running against him this time. Are there other races that are open seats that would give her a shot? Last thing she wants to do is run again and lose. After that, it would be a lot more difficult if she was looking down the line. She's a very young lady, very, very accomplished. If she's looking down the line, it may be this isn't the time to run. But that is yet to be seen. Dick, did you see how much she's raised at all?
No, I haven't.
So that'll be another interesting thing to look at, to see if she's raised money and for what.
Mm-hmm. Before we wrap up, though, I got a prediction for you. Let's see if Lou agrees with this. Clerk of the court, our good friend Lady Gardner, unfortunately passed away. There's a vacancy there. I predict the governor will appoint Hispanic.
Yeah, and I would even go a little bit further than that. If I was going to go out on a limb, I would say female Hispanic.
Keep in mind there's been a contest about whether or not we have a Hispanic county commissioner. We do not. There's been a threatened lawsuit on that for reapportionment, and this gives a chance to the governor to appoint his highly visible Hispanic clerk of the court in Orange County.
Well, Dick Batchelor, former Democratic State House representative and head of the Dick Batchelor Management Group, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And also Lou Fry, former Republican congressman and an attorney at Lowndes, Drostick, Doster, Canton, Reed. Always a pleasure.
Look forward to coming back.
Up next, a conversation with Keith Koch, the warning coordinator at the Orange County Office of Emergency Management, about preparing for disasters. I'm joined in the studio by Keith Koch. Keith is the warning coordinator at the Orange County Office of Emergency Management. Keith, thanks for joining me.
Glad to be here.
Keith, just for a start, what does a warning coordinator do?
Okay. My responsibilities with the office primarily is to monitor and the systems that we have in place to notify the community, notify the public, notify the responders of any emergency situations or what's needed to be done in the area. We use a variety of tools to do that. Other duties that I have is I maintain the Emergency Operations Center for the county and make sure from a technological standpoint that it is ready to be activated at any time 24/7.
Now, you have a pretty big county in terms of population to deal with. If there were a major emergency like a hurricane sweeping through or something, what would happen first? People would be directed to go to certain shelters, that kind of thing?
The first steps, of course, is an awareness, is through several steps. We want people to be aware throughout the year, not just of hurricanes, but any hazards that might befall them while in Orange County. Especially this time of year, our focus, of course, turns toward hurricane season and the potential impacts that we may have. We depend on people watching news reports, listening to the news via radio, via television, internet, social media, however they get their news. You know, it's very important that people do that on a regular basis to keep informed of the situation. When an incident is pending, is either happening or occurring in the county or pending, they're going to hear specific instructions from government officials that we want them to take certain actions or to do certain things. And we will use various methods to do that. And it's just, first of all, the first part is being aware of what's going on and be willing to listen to and respond to any action requests that we may make.
The Center for Ocean Atmospheric Prediction Studies at Florida State University is predicting an above-average hurricane season. I know these things are kind of flexible as the season evolves. It's often hard to tell exactly what's going to happen, but is this something you take note of at the start of the season, or is it strictly business as usual? Do you always prepare in the same way, no matter what predictions are being made about the number of hurricanes that might come through Florida?
We will prepare regardless of whether they're predicting one storm or 100 storms. The preparation that needs to take place makes no difference because it only takes one storm to impact a community that can have devastating effects. So we're always prepared to handle whatever may happen. If it's just one storm this year that directly affects Orange County, or if it's like the 2004 hurricane season where we had three in a row over a six-week period of time, we prepare the same way.
Mm-hmm. And 2004, that was Charlie, right, with the one that came through Orlando?
That's correct. The first one of that season was Charlie, Hurricane Charlie. Then there was Hurricane Francis and Jean, mm-hmm. were the three ones that directly impacted the county.
What did you learn from that season? That's a while back now, almost a decade ago.
It certainly is. A lot of things came out of that storm, and one was the way that we communicate with the citizens in the county. As a result of activity during that time, a county 311 information line was born and made available to them so that the citizenry has a single number that they can call during an activation, what we call an activation when the county has ramped up, I guess you want to say, and are in the mode of responding to a disaster. When that happens, this 311 line goes 24/7, so that people have a one number they can call to find out, you know, where's the closest shelter, do we need to evacuate, to report damage after the storm, things like that. So that came out of the 2004 season.
Do you feel like people now have better access to information because of things like social media? Does that help getting the word out during storms and their aftermath, or are you still faced with problems because the infrastructure might be knocked out by a big storm?
Mm-hmm. The advent of social media is new to us as far as county response. This will be the first hurricane season where we've instituted social media in the form of Twitter, Facebook, to have direct contact to the public. It has probably a good side and a bad side. Of course, with so many people with smartphones and being social media savvy, it's an excellent way to get information out to people. The downside of it, it's also an excellent way for rumors to be born and spread.
Sure.
And, you know, it's the public just needs to be aware. They need to listen to the official sources of information, and we'll strive to do our best to get that information out to them. So if there's a conflict between what they're hearing and what, you know, government is telling them, we need to know about that. We need to know that that's going on, and we can address that.
Mm-hmm. Now, your office has an amateur radio division as well, and this is slightly older technology, I guess, but it obviously works because you still have this unit going. How would that work in a disaster? How would you deploy it?
Well, as a matter of fact, I happen to also be an amateur radio operator myself. And what we typically will use amateur radio operators for is to provide backup communications that may be almost primary communications from a shelter location back to our emergency operations center, because so many of the shelters are in schools that may have a phone system that's dependent upon power, or that could go out. Our radio to radio works. And the thing about amateur radio is the people that are involved in the public service side of that are practiced in putting up temporary antennas, portable radio stations. They're not dependent on some large network in order to operate. We use networks ourselves. We have radio repeaters, which extend the range of radios, that we'll use them as much as possible. But when that goes down and it can lose power or antenna damaged, tower damaged, we have the ability to do point-to-point through just very simplex frequencies, and we can relay information. We practice that. We also have the capability of not only local communications, but what we call long-haul communications, maybe from here to Tallahassee through HF frequencies, long-range radio frequencies that are practiced daily, as a matter of fact, every day except Sunday. There's a statewide net that comes on HF, and it's to practice propagation, radio conditions throughout the state, to make sure that we have that capability of passing critical information when it's needed.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE FM. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm talking to Keith Koch, who's the warning coordinator at the Orange County Office of Emergency Management. We're talking about responses to emergencies. And you can join the conversation on Twitter or Facebook. You can also send us an email, intersection@wmfe.org. Keith, I want to talk too about how your organization in Orange County works in with the likes of FEMA and other state agencies. How does that all fit together during a large weather event or some other kind of disaster?
You might hear in on TV or media or look on the internet, you might see or hear some terminology that somebody has said that all disasters are local in nature. They all start locally. They're expected to be handled locally, first of all. Our relationship with not only FEMA but the state level, it's a progressive relationship. We are responsible locally for response, recovery, mitigation efforts, preparation, training, things like that, to the extent of our resources that we have. If we exceed the capabilities that we have locally, we have the ability to turn, first of all, to the state of Florida for their help through mutual aid agreements with other counties, with other agencies, with the state, to get additional resources in to handle an issue that we need help with. If the state runs out of resources, then they in turn look to the federal government through FEMA to help provide those additional resources, again, through mutual aid agreements with other states, with the federal agencies. And that's how it goes. We work from the local upward by requesting additional help. The state and FEMA will not just come in and take things over. There's a prescribed way of doing things and a process of doing that.
Just coming back to the idea of coordination, and I'm wondering, how do you deal with offers of help, unsolicited offers of help coming in? How do you coordinate that? Because I'm thinking now about the Oklahoma tornadoes from a wee while back, and there were, I mean, it's a good thing that people want to help. They want to offer their assistance, and they do, but how do you sort of deal with all of that?
So the best thing to do is to let the community get the word out what they need, when they need it, where they need it. Do they need manpower? What kind of manpower? Do they need people with certain skills? Work through the local emergency management agency. In our case, you call, you get a hold of us probably through County 311 phone number. Those requests or those offers for help can be filtered into our emergency support function that handles that they will vet the person, vet the supplies coming in, make arrangements to get it and to distribute it how it's needed. We do have, if people are interested in volunteering, they can go to the county website, county government website, and there is a tab on there. You can look up how to volunteer or something. And you can go on there and actually register yourself, your needs, your skill sets, and be placed into an area that you could be used in the county in the event of maybe day-to-day normal activities or in emergencies.
Is that something you've used before?
Yes.
And has it worked?
Yes. You know, it probably works better if we know people in advance what their skills are. We can bring them into training situations to help train them on if they're going to be helping distribute supplies at a distribution site. You know, we want to work with them ahead of time. It makes it much easier, of course, if somebody's been trained on how we're going to operate those sites, what to do. It may be teams that go out after a weather event and help tarp roofs, mm-hmm. you know, that need that. Work with our fire department responders or other agencies that are responding. It may be chainsaw people, you know. But we can pre-vet them and know that we are getting somebody that knows our system, that we've trained, we've worked with, we know who they are, and you know, there are some background checks involved, you know, that need to be done for public safety.
Sure.
Depends on what interaction they're going to have with the public as to what type of checks. But you know, we want to make sure that whoever is helping, you know, our community is has the right motivation to do it, mm-hmm. you know, and they're properly trained and equipped to do the job safely and effectively, mm-hmm. with no further impact to what we need to be doing.
Finally, Keith, I'm wondering, looking at this forecast for the hurricane season in 2013, are you concerned at all? You feel like the Orange County is in a good state? Are they well prepared?
I think we're well prepared. We begin, of course, we keep preparing all year long, of course, but we do, again, ramp up beginning in about February. We start looking toward the new hurricane season coming up with specific training, because that's the most likely impact that we're going to have throughout the year. So we begin training all our emergency support functions, how we're going to respond. We go over plans. We update plans, review them, have those agencies review their emergency operations plans. You know, how are they going to respond if they can't work at their normal place of work? Where do they go to? How do they operate, keep county government running, keep the services to the public going if they don't have the normal methods? So all those plans are reviewed. They're updated. The people that work in our emergency operations center are brought in for specific training on the systems that we use there. And that's an ongoing process. We're still actually doing some of that now as we move into the peak of the hurricane season, mid-August to mid-September. Mm-hmm. That's the most likely impact we would have at time of impact. So we're afforded the first part of the season, of course, to continue that training. But we do it on a regular basis, whether we're impacted or not. So I think that we are very well prepared. Over the years, just that experience that we've had, we've got a lot of people with experience in the response area, and we've learned from past lessons.
I've been speaking to Keith Koch. Keith is the warning coordinator at the Orange County Office of Emergency Management. Keith, thanks for coming by.
I appreciate the opportunity.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrd is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.